Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And on this week's New Statesman podcast,
we talk about women and power.
We talk about heirs.
And graces and the Labour and Tory successions. So some of you will have heard the advert on our podcast for the play Mary Stuart, which is just transferred to the West End. As promised, I took Stephen on the New Statesman podcast school trip last night. Now, theatre people get very cross if you review the production during previews, but I thought it would be a really interesting way to jump off talking about a couple of different things. So one of the things that was interesting about the play...
Do they get cross if you review it and you say it was good? Because
no.
I liked it.
No, they probably don't, actually. They probably see fit to overlook that.
Well, okay, in that case, my review is I liked it, it's going on tour... It's worth a go. It's very long, though, so make sure that you have peed literally as close to sitting down as possible.
Yeah, I spent almost the entire interval in the ladies' loo queue, which once paid off, actually. When I went to see the Queen Anne that the RSC did, I got to explain the Stuart succession to a group of American tourists, which is literally my happy place in all of the world. They were really interested to say what I had to say about Sophia, Electress of Hanover. Anyway...
Were they interested or polite?
No. They asked me. I was explaining it to one friend, and then I gathered an appreciative group who really wanted to know why Catholics were excluded from the succession of the British monarchy. Honestly, if John could have teleported there, he would have been the happiest man alive. But I digress. The reason I thought it was interesting play, because when it was on the first time, they were developing it at the time, it was Andrea Leadsom versus Theresa May for the Tory leadership.
Oh, is that why they've got their nifty haircuts?
I don't think that's why they've got their nifty haircuts, but they do. So the premise of the...
Sorry,
the kind of...
this preview rule that I've just learned out. Haircuts, which may or may not have been nifty.
So they spin a coin at the start, and one of them calls heads, ironically. And then of the two leads, Juliet Stevenson and Leah Williams, one of them plays Mary, one of them plays Elizabeth, with the idea that, you know, you could be in the shoes of someone else and fate leads you to one place or another. And also that actually you kind of can't, as a woman, you can't have it all. You can either be the kind of bitch virgin queen, in which case you kind of get respect from men, but at the cost of them sort of also hating you for being frigid, or you can be kind of maternal and sexy at the cost of men unfortunately disrespecting you because they think you're a slag. That's not really how the blank verse presents it, but that's my gloss on it. And I think it's really interesting because we now have a situation in Scotland where you have First Minister's Questions with Nicola Sturgeon versus the Tory Scottish leader Ruth Davidson. And now we've been talking a little bit about the Labour succession this week. And actually, there is a strong feeling in the Labour Party it should be a woman next time. I wouldn't put it past them still to elect a bloke, but that is the kind of where the general mood is. And the names Emily Thornberry, Angela Rayner, and now from the left, Laura Pidcock, who's very new, have all kind of come into the frame. So I thought, first of all, let's talk about women and power, Stephen. What do they want? What can be done about it?
I presume they want power. So I think the interesting thing about the fact that politics, I am just going to nick this phrase from before we went on air, politics now passes the Bechdel test.
It's all right, I said it on Women's Hour, so it's out there now.
Okay. And then I think there are a couple of interesting trends about that. One is, recently, as I think I mentioned last week on the podcast, I went to see some of Britain Thinks's podcasts.
Focus groups.
Focus groups. We do podcasts. They do focus groups.
No, they also do podcasts.
And the thing I thought was really interesting about that is how in both the groups, they were both very critical, both young and old, about Theresa May. And the thing that they said in both cases is Thatcher wannabe, because people's idea of what a successful woman in wielding power in the United Kingdom is Margaret Thatcher. My suspicion is that when Angela Merkel does leave the scene, which obviously may be sooner than we think, then she similarly will cast quite a long shadow over what it is to be, over what a successful woman politician should look like.
But I think that's also comes back to Elizabeth I as well as a model for female power, because that is someone who surrounded themselves with male courtiers, which is notoriously what Thatcher appointed, I think, one woman to her cabinet an entire time that she was there, and kind of revelled in this idea that she was sui generis. You know that famous speech that Elizabeth gives, I'm going to say at Tilbury, you know, I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king. She did an explicit thing where she said, yes, I might by accident at birth have been a woman, but I'm not like women, you know, I'm as good as a man. And I think that was very much the kind of Thatcher model of power. And when I talk to Labour women MPs, that's how they feel. They feel there's a really good template for success as a woman in the Tory party, but it comes from saying, I am an exceptional, you know, I'm as good as a man, which is less their vision, which is more a socialist vision, which is that we have to bring up all women. So in some ways, they feel that their vision is more threatening to kind of patriarchy and the established order.
But so I think one of the interesting things about the fact that you have, and obviously before you had Kezia Dugdale, although obviously people didn't really regard the Labour Party she led as, you know, a viable project. But it does mean that you have a significantly broader idea of what female leadership looks like, which does mean that it's less constrained, I suspect. So shall we start with the Labour leadership and then go to the Tories next?
Yeah.
I think, because I think the fascinating thing about the Labour Party is, although I think it is more likely than not that Jeremy Corbyn will lead Labour into the 2022 election, it is a live possibility that he won't. It is a possibility that certainly some people around him are preparing for, hence this kind of like, I mean, some of the lists of people who've been abandoned successors are flatly wrong. You know, Clive Lewis was never really considered a successor by the leader's office.
I think possibly by Clive Lewis, he might.
And he was considered like a successor by like lots of kind of pro-Corbyn commentators, but that isn't really the same thing.
Rebecca Long Bailey was.
Angela Rayner was considered a Corbynite by a bunch of Corbyn skeptic commentators. So there's this slightly,
who hadn't listened to anything that she'd said.
Yeah, there's this slightly disingenuous thing of like a certain type of like political journalist who has not, I think it would be fair to say, approached the Corbyn project in a particularly professional manner, who has started by going, oh, she's the Corbynite successor, finally been forced to listen to like, you know, a speech by Angela Rayner and gone like, oh yeah, she's on the left, which is not a Corbynite. They've abandoned her as a successor. And it's like, no, like this narrative existed, you know, it is solely emanated from you.
Something I do think you have to mention, yeah, when you're talking about both of them, actually. And actually, when if we bring Laura Pidcock into that, because she's the MP for Northwest Durham, she's 31, she was elected at the last, in 2017. And I think her first big major media thing actually was when I think I hosted Week in Westminster, and I wanted to do a discussion about young people not being able to afford to buy houses. And she came on because at the time she didn't have a house. She has since bought one, leading to a kind of classic Daily Mail hatchet job about the kind of, you know, MP moans they can't afford a house despite £72,000 salary. Unfortunately, ignoring one of the massive problems of the housing market for young people, which is that it's so stacked towards people with existing capital. You can have a very high salary, but if you can't lay your hands on tens of thousands of pounds, you can't get a mortgage. Anyway, I thought she was really impressive then. But
also, the thing is, crucially, she couldn't, with her salary, buy a house in commuting distance of the place where she, you know, actually works. Like, you know,
you mean Westminster rather than Northwest Durham?
Yeah, I mean, this thing's just like, I'm sure it's a very beautiful house, because a 70 grand salary can buy you quite a beautiful house in Northwest Durham, which means, you know, in the recess and in the 3 days of the week she's doing her surgeries, yeah, she's got a great house. However, right, like, it is a bit troubling that even people who earn 70 grand a year, and in the case of like the Labour MP for Northwest Durham, let's face it, if you're a bank, you probably feel confident in betting she will continue to earn 70 grand a year for the foreseeable future, could not, you know, is unable to buy a flat within commuting distance of the Palace of Westminster on her own without having to scare up a fairly large deposit, right? That is not the sign, I would argue, of a successful housing market. The fact that it happens that she lives somewhere where the kind of, because obviously the housing crisis in London is the jobs crisis elsewhere, despite the fact she lives in she represents a constituency which is the other end of it. And although, yes, I continue to find it annoying when MPs who do not live in their patches use their constituents as a proxy for, like, you know, bowing to any number of, like, bad ideas on the economy or immigration or whatever. But actually, like, I am intensely relaxed with MPs spending most of their working week when Parliament is sitting near Parliament.
Oh, yeah. So am I. I just say that as a reference to the fact that she's, I think she's very impressive. She's one of those people who came in like Jess Phillips at the last election, and you just thought, wow, you are somebody who you can put, you know, who comes in, is incredibly forceful, incredibly articulate at putting your arguments forward, you know. Very different from maybe whether or not you'd succeed in a ministerial brief or succeed as leader, but one of those people who immediately comes in and people go, ooh, hello. But the thing that's interesting is, you know, Jo Swinson did not stand for the Lib Dem leadership, and actually she's currently pregnant with her second child, and I'm sure those two decisions were not entirely unlinked. Laura is at the start of her 30s, that decision is ahead of her, whereas Angela Rayner is, because she had her kids so young, is already grandula, as she calls herself, she's already grandmother, and Emily Thornberry's children are older.
Which is, yeah, because I feel like Angela Rayner's younger children, because she had Ryan and her own,
still smaller than but coming up to the age where it's, you know, I think still being a party leader with babies or toddlers is, I mean, you know, there are people like Harriet Harman who just absolutely bludgeoned through it. You know, she turned up in the Commons in 1982, 5 months pregnant, as one of only something, you know, crazy small number of MPs, and just kind of decided to, that she was just going to bulldoze her way through. But for lots of other people, those decisions are very hard to make. So what's interesting about where we are with women in politics at the moment is so many of the successful leaders are childless, which is something I wrote about in our cover story a couple of years ago. And other ones of them are coming in, you know, the idea of a trend to slightly older leaders is really advantageous to women. And that's what Baroness Anne Jenkin, the Tory peer who ran and still runs Women to Win with Theresa May, said about getting women in their 50s into Parliament. She's like, well, this is a chance to have a whole new generation who wouldn't have considered these careers in their 30s. They will now consider them in their 50s. So I think that's really kind of important. Tory succession. So this is the other thing that I picked up from Mary Stewart, is the intense anxiety of a country with no succession plan.
Kick the tires of the Labour candidates in slightly more detail.
You can kick all the tires.
Because I think the interesting thing is that, you know, the central forecast isn't this won't happen until 2022 anyway, but or until, you know, sometime after 2022. I think so far I would say, I think Emily Thornberry, of the kind of three people who are being talked about, who I would, you know, if someone said who would you bet money on, I'd go, oh, well, you've got a fairly decentest chance of getting it back if you put it on any of Emily Thornberry, Angela Rayner, and Laura Pidcock. And then if you wanted to, like, make a lot of money, but you didn't mind that much about getting the money you were putting down back, you'd bet on John Ashworth as, like, a, like, hilarious left field, like, but semi-plausible. Like, yeah, in terms of the people who have quite long odds at the moment, he's definitely the only one that would
Yeah, because Emily Thornberry, when I checked this week, was at 6-1, I think, and Angela Rayner about the same. So they're, you know, they're kind of solid leaders about, you're not going to make an enormous amount of money on them.
But so the thing I think that Angela Rayner is doing quite a bad job of is she's kind of somehow managing to run for it to a position, from a position that's actually to her right at the moment.
I think the other problem she's having is she's running for it too obviously. She's done quite a lot of press, and I guess maybe she just feels she needs to do that initial blitz of press where everyone does the story about, you know, her personal life story, you know, about the fact that her mum was illiterate, she had her kids very young, and then she's, you know, she really wants to bring a kind of different voice to Parliament. And when everybody's kind of done that, then she feels that she will then have permission to actually kind of talk about policies, right? And we have to get past the biography first, whereas Emily Thornberry has been in Parliament for a lot longer, you know, already kind of has that permission.
Yeah. And yeah, the interesting thing is, like, obviously, like, lots of people are very excited about Laura Pidcock. However, as with Becky Long Bailey, it is not entirely clear to me how much that excitement is necessarily shared by the candidate who might want to have been in Parliament for a bit longer. My very strong impression, and indeed what was very clear from the first sort of set of polling that YouGov did and was not published, but then obviously we obtained and wrote about on the NS website, was that was taken after the Newsnight hustings at 7 p.m. on BBC One. The average Labour member, it's very important to remember, is actually a lot less politically engaged than the average person who listens to the New Statesman podcast. I just think that people hugely underestimate how powerful a position Emily Thornberry is in with that group, for having been someone who, like, was on TV defending Ed Miliband, was on TV defending Jeremy Corbyn, and crucially is like them. She is, you know, like, from the South, you know, did not come from a, like, super privileged background, but has, like, made something of herself. Right?
I think it's really
fascinating.
Which is
actually, like, that is the median Labour member is someone in their 50s who, like, you know, maybe the first in their family to go to university, or the first in their family to, you know, get promoted above supervisor level or whatever, now owns their own house and is quite worried about their children's prospects. You've just described like the Corbyn coalition as far as his leadership victory. And for lots of reasons, Emily Thornberry is doing the best job of appealing to that group at the moment.
I think it's really fascinating that Tories always will try and attack her by calling her Lady Noogie, because her husband is...
Oh, it's such a character tell.
Sir Christopher Noogie,
like
who's a High Court
George
judge.
It's like George Osborne Gideon. It's just the kind of thing where it's just like, you have outed yourself as a word I cannot use on the NS podcast.
It is a bit, oh, Zanu Libor, isn't it? It's like, you think this is clever, but actually this
but
is
also
just
like
significantly
call people
dumb.
What they want to be called. It's just so unnecessarily it's just like the only thing that it's revealing about is of the character of the person doing it.
Yeah, but. Like it's like me on feminist principles insisting on referring to Teresa Brazier because I don't think that people should take their husband's names on marriage. That's fine. I can think that. I can choose not to do that in my case. But trying to impose that on everybody else just makes you look like a bit of a tit.
Yeah.
So I think, but that's you can see there the outline of what hilariously, the Tories are going to decide to attack the Labour leader for being too posh, which is, you know, something that works for them. I don't know if they've necessarily got their Angela Rayner attack line ready yet, because they did try to gently suggest the suggestion that she was really thick, and it backfired massively because people went, are you just saying that because she's got a northern accent? And I think that makes a huge number of the country just go, hang on a minute, is that the kind of thing that the Tory, you know, it pokes that button of, the, is that how the Tory party feel about us? They think that we're the kind of great unwashed. So I think they would kind of struggle with that a bit. But, I just think the question of who the unions swing behind is a really interesting one. And there, I would put Emily Thornberry ahead on that measure.
Well, this is the other important thing about Laura Pidcock's promotion, because she's minister. Although my kind of, I do think people have kind of not noticed that actually the difficulty for the trade unions with the Collins post-Collins review system is they have the only control they have is their ability to encourage MPs to nominate or not nominate certain people. That threshold has already been lowered, and if any, it's definitely not going to go up, right? And actually, so lots of people in the trade unions did a very heroic job of spinning that, oh, we've managed to get our people to vote because they made up a larger proportion of the people voting in the Scottish Labour leadership election. But that's because there are still like 35,000 members or some other like hilariously small pre-Corbyn number of people who are members in the Scottish Labour Party. The reason why the trade union proportion was higher is ultimately if you can successfully get like everyone who's a rep or, you know, who works for Unite in a political sense to vote in the Scottish Labour leadership election, well done. You've successfully increased the proportion of trade union affiliates. However, the actual raw number is still derisory, which means that beyond it meaning that you don't have to worry about hiring your staff, you know, paying your, you know, the money for your staff comes from.
Because
the
Unite for Jeremy did, I mean, they gave him a lot of money for that leadership
campaign.
And it's
like office space and like just all of that kind of stuff does make your life a lot easier. But crucially, if you are a viable candidate for an internal party election, you do not lack for volunteers. You do not lack for like space given to you for free by volunteers, right? So actually, even that advantage, although it is like good for meaning that, you know, the campaign manager doesn't continually have to sit there going, oh God, how can I, you know, make this add up? What about my Facebook videos? You know, what about my targeted ads, right? Although the union money is really important and crucial to that kind of thing, if the Labour Party basically ends up with a situation where it is kind of having a proper primary by default, because, you know, let's say the Labour Party just keeps growing at every election because it continues to have, like, the registered supporter scheme at a reasonably low rate. And I think after the hilarious failure to not have to kill it by raising it, that it feels more like...
Well, the counterpoint to that is that the Labour Party until 2 years ago had enormous cash problems, huge cash problems. And now it is, you know, we're like Scrooge McDuck over there. They could kind of go down a slide into a pile of pound coins.
Yeah. But so let's say Labour kind of keeps increasing the size of its electorate, then, which is why I think it's odd. There are two groups in the party who I think should embrace primaries for tactical. Also, I think primaries are good, but for tactical, one is the right of the party because
they need to get better. If they want to win.
Yeah, they just, yeah, it would be an incentive to them to improve. But the other group are actually the trade unions, because in the reality is if Labour had primaries, you can then like go, yeah, you can't take money from like KPMG, X, Y, and Z, right? You then can restrict who pays for it. And then suddenly the fact that they are the deepest pockets in the movement does slightly give them a measure of control over the outcome. than they at present do not have. So I think like the endorsement of the unions is nice to have, I guess, but I just don't think it actually matters all that much. I mean, as indeed Jeremy Corbyn's 2015 election campaign, where, yes, he did got the endorsements of a reasonable number of trade unions, but they all very much had to be dragged there by events, right? That none of the big general secretaries, with the partial exception of Dave Ward at the CWU, who obviously changed over midway through that leadership election. Yeah, I mean, the general secretary himself was elected at the same time. Started that election thinking they were going to back Jeremy Corbyn. So it doesn't matter.
That's interesting. Well, the other thing, I guess, the big learning from Mary Stuart is this idea about how succession is kind of unpredictable and also something that makes people very nervous. So in the play, obviously, it's about the fact that Elizabeth's a Protestant, Mary's a Catholic. No one, I don't think anyone would have predicted in sort of 1575 that what was actually going to happen was that Elizabeth was going to live for another 30 years and that it would then go to James I of England and VI of Scotland. And so, not to contradict everything that's gone before, but it is now entirely possible that it will be someone. I think you mentioned someone like Dan Carden, you know, the MP for Liverpool Walton, who came in strongly backed by Unite. And has kind of kept a low profile. He's now a Minister for State in the International Development.
And I think, like, you know,
it could just be someone we haven't even crossed our radar. If you presume that Jeremy Corbyn is going to stay on for a long time, like Elizabeth I, he's just going to go on and on.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think then people are, on the whole, underrating the likelihood that Corbyn will fight the next election. But, you know, then someone like Dan Carden, who are kind of in a line, I think we ended up cutting from my column this week, then it's hard to sort of think of an example of someone coming into Westminster full stop with such a big pre-existing reputation in their party since Clegg, Miliband and Balls came in 2005. And of course, 2 years later, Clegg was leader of his party. The Eds were in the cabinet. And 3 years later, Ed Miliband was leader. So there are people like that who have, and he has done the very sensible thing of a big name arriving in Parliament, which is he hasn't irritated any of the sort of greybeards by making a name for himself and has just quietly and diligently got on with the job of being an MP. And so he's someone who you know, could yet surprise people.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
On the Tory side.
Well, that's what I think. I think the Tory succession is in a way more interesting because if you think about what the kind of optics of the Labour succession it will be somebody who promises essentially to the membership not a counter-revolution, right? That's my very strong feeling. If something happened and actually, you know, events really changed, Corbyn was massively wiped out in the next election, or if he became Prime Minister and it all went appallingly wrong, then you would then expect the pendulum to swing back. But if it's a leadership election in the kind of current mood, I would expect someone to run as kind of, I'm guarantor of the project, I'm going to keep going.
The interesting thing is bizarrely, I think the next Labour leadership election, if it doesn't happen after, well, so let's say there are three paths to a leadership election, which you've sort of outlined well. Corbyn is Prime Minister and it ends in tears. Corbyn is Prime Minister and steps down after 2 years and it's hugely successful. And then Corbyn steps down before the election and then, you know, like, something happens to Corbyn and he has to stand down for, you know, health reasons. Now, in three out of those four things, all of the candidates will run on a I am like Corbyn Mark II, but I'm more electable. Weirdly, so not more electable than Corbyn, but more electable than the other flavours of Corbyn on offer. And I think in some ways,
yes, I'm your best chance of a Corbyn-style government.
It will
the kind of
probably
promise.
Be quite a. Maybe it would personal in a nasty way, but I suspect it possibly will become quite acrimonious because you will have at least three candidates who will not be running on policy platforms and are that divergent from one another. You will, and so there will partly be a kind of incentive to be like, that one's the Tory, but there will also be an incentive to go like, yeah, but like, come on, obviously, like, me plus Corbynism is electoral success.
Yeah.
Then plus Corbynism, well, that would be a disaster.
Rather than being like, I think we've got very different approaches to schools and the NHS.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas the Tories are in a different place, right? Nobody wants continuity May. That's
Theresa May does.
Yeah, okay. With the exception of Theresa May and, you know, Philip May and some people around Theresa May. That's not how you don't run as the guarantor of the May project, because the May project so far has been one quite good speech outside Downing Street and then losing an election you didn't have to call.
Yeah.
Still funny.
And also, so yeah, the Tory leadership election is just a lot more interesting for exactly that reason, but also because, and something I think that not enough people have clocked, there will be loads and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of candidates.
Is this the sort of, on the basis in the same way that Syed Javid and Stephen Crabb ran last time, and a kind of, we know we're not going to win this, but we want to make sure that we're out there. Or the way that Liam Fox ran to be like, I just want to remind you, I have got a faction of 12 MPs, you know, that who bend to my whim, improbably.
So there will be someone from, you know, currently in the wilderness who runs as a kind of like, hey, I'm still relevant. Oh, and obviously this thing is not...
Jacob Rees-Mogg, I would say, think he's just going to run?
He's ruled himself out, but I kind
of... But Michael Gove explicitly ruled himself out. It just means nothing.
But yeah, so there'll be someone... So yeah, there will be various candidates who run to place, as it were. You know, just to kind of go like, hey guys, I'm still here. There will be some people from the cabinet who will run in a kind of, if I'm a candidate and I do well, I can't be sacked, because the assumption will be that the new leader, whoever they are, does a fairly big reshuffle. There will be some people who run to win. There will be some people who run for, you know,
favors.
Various facts. Yeah, there will just there are. I mean, in an odd way. I mean, obviously they can't all run, but it's, you know, kind of one of those quite fun sort of like collective action problems, right? If you went through every single member of the cabinet, the tactical argument why they personally should mount a run is really strong in every single case. And that holds true for quite a large sort of substrata of the Minister of State level. Now, obviously, not every cabinet minister and not every Minister of State and not every like backbencher or select committee chair with a high opinion of themselves will run. However, I think it is quite likely that at least three people from each of those categories I listed will end up making some form of bid. It will be quite a crowded field, so it also...
I love that, though. I love that, because that's when mad stuff happens, and just someone kind of completely comes... You just don't expect... I think that would be an incredibly healthy thing from the Tory party, which just seems to be having a kind of complete nervous breakdown. Like, it does need to do a proper accounting of what went wrong. But, you know, I mentioned this about the sort of... I went slightly further back in history and said, you know, of the NEC elections, so John Landsman and the Momentum slate did really well. They've now replaced... Anne Black, a swing voter, with Christine Shawcross from the Disputes Resolution Committee chair. So, you know, that is now a firmly pro-Corbyn majority on the NEC. So Corbyn has now great consolidated his party power. However, he does have what I would call the kind of Henry VIII problem, which is he does have no obvious heir. Like, there is no one that is anointed by him. There are lots of people who have been pushed by various factions. But that also raises the question about whether or not the anointed successor is even is there any point doing that as a prime minister? You know, David Cameron firmly believed that George Osborne was going to guarantee his project. Tony Blair sort of knew, even though he maybe wasn't too happy about it, that Brown would carry on some of the big goals about child poverty and things like that. Some of the new Labour,
like the Blairite Brown, I think, was like mainly like the vanity of small differences and the euro.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, Gove unpicking everything that Chris Grayling did at the Ministry of Justice, right? It was some big, you know, there were a couple of issues that they really disagreed on. But actually, can you ever have a succession that is handed out? I mean, the other classic example being Hillary Clinton running as third term Obama and having support from a very popular president, and it's still not really being enough.
So the fascinating thing about the history of political parties is, in general, the succession does not work out. It does, obviously, in the States, but when you have a vice president, it's quite different. And obviously, the history of vice presidents successfully running after two terms is, again, not great. You know, but the weird thing in UK politics is, weirdly, with the exception of Thatcher and Major, where he happens to be her designated successor, you know, that month, but she kind of had gone through so many.
But the music stopped,
and
yeah.
Probably, you know, and she then turned out she wasn't happy with that designated successor either. In an odd way, the reason why it's good to have one is it prevents people freaking out. right?
Well, that, but then again, that takes you back to Elizabeth I, right?
Yeah.
Is that you might think, and you know, what is what people want, or in Henry VIII, you know, what people want is some guarantee that, you know, from the veterinary line, from the Terry Pratchett books, what most people want is a guarantee that tomorrow will be mostly the same as today.
Yeah, and that's the thing, in an odd way, the thing that the idea that Osborne was Cameron's preferred heir kind of gave them throughout the whole project was this sense of, oh, okay, there's been a reshuffle, and the way to do well is to be in with Osborne, because Cameron wins Osborne. And so it kind of gave, you know, every MPs a sense of, like, parameters, so it gave them a sense of stability. And that made the government's life slightly easier than it otherwise would have been.
And also it felt a more stable government. We were talking last week about the reshuffle, and it's notable how many people stayed in post much longer under Cameron. You know, he was much... David Lidington, I think, was Europe Minister for almost the entire time.
Yeah, Cameron didn't really like reshuffles. I think this is the other thing, is that one of the most effective ways to get your way if you're a party leader is the idea of revenge, right? Not necessarily that you will do it, but then either you or someone who broadly shares your interests will be around to continue to take revenge. One of May's many difficulties is the idea that, like, making yourself an enemy for life in Theresa May is a problem for you, just doesn't hold water in the Conservative Party. Now, obviously, if she had a designated successor, that successor, if anything, would have a harder job becoming leader. You know, one of the main difficulties for Gavin Williamson is the perception that is growing that he is Theresa May's last Horcrux.
You finally got to use that on the podcast.
Finally.
How many people have I heard you describe as someone's last Horcrux over the last couple of years? That's brilliant.
In many ways, that analogy is...
it's your last Horcrux. Yes, that's true. But yeah, there are other problems with Gavin Williamson as well, not least the fact that everyone in the Tory party seems to wildly dislike him. I mean, that guy needs to go on a charm offensive.
This is the problem. I keep kind of collecting anecdotes of the kind you can't use because it would be obvious who they came from. But obviously the commonality is I now have like 100 like very personal anecdotes of just like then he did this thing which really annoyed me.
But that's the problem with coming up through the Whip's office as well. Contra House of Cards, it's actually, although you've got loads of dirt on people, you've also often personally upset them or screwed them over in some way or strong-armed them. So it is tough. But also he does so far seem to have leaned into that persona by getting a tarantula called Cronus. I mean, that's not the actions of someone who wants to soften.
It's a bit like being a fresher who decides their personality isn't they've got a hat, isn't it?
It is a bit. Do you know what it's really redolent of? Actually, it's redolent of Theresa May and the leopard skin shoes, and those were her personality for like a decade. Well, that's a sad and depressing note to. But we give people some good betting advice at least, or maybe as it will turn out, bad betting advice. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. We're recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. And you can find out more and links to all the things we talked about in the show at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.